This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
We're going to be talking about HIV/AIDS research and development, and joining us in the studio is Associate Professor Paul Gorry from the Burnet Institute and Chad Hughes. There's a whole lot happening with HIV research in various areas, and Chad, tell us about your role at the Burnet Institute. You're not involved in the scientific or the virological side of things, are you?
No, I work for the public health arm of Burnet. We have the lab-based programs, which do the sort of research.
Yep.
And then we have public health programs where we work with communities about how they respond to HIV.
Yeah.
So my work is with the Centre for International Health.
Yep.
We have a number of offices and programs throughout Asia and the Pacific, and also a program in Southern Africa.
So your work is essentially in that whole area, not just within Australia, but in all of those areas?
Yeah, my work is primarily overseas. So what I do is I support programs in our other countries where we work. I work in Papua New Guinea, in Laos, and in Burma.
Yeah.
And we have offices over there with a team, and what we do is support them to respond to the epidemic in their own context.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it better for people from the same culture, from the same country, to present that sort of thing? This more aware of the cultural sort of nuances and things?
Yeah, it is, and that's why we have local staff over there. So what we do really is a facilitation role and a capacity building role. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we go over and support them with the information that they need and the skills, and build their skills to respond to the epidemic. So, for example, the responses are locally driven. So we'll help them do an analysis of what the needs are, what the vulnerabilities to HIV are in their communities, what risks people are taking, and then they come up with the solutions themselves. And all we do is inform the content of that to make sure that it's going to be the most effective program.
And what are the kinds of issues that tend to come up? Or do they vary much from country to country, or do they tend to have a... Is there a common element across the board?
Well, they do vary from context to context. I mean, Laos is a low-prevalence country, so what we do there is we work with people who are engaged in behaviours which will put them at higher risk for HIV, like sex between men, and we work with commercial sex and commercial sex workers. In Papua New Guinea, where the epidemic is a little bit more concentrated and throughout the general population, the sort of issues are around development, gender, poverty. So there's a development arm to the work that we do as well.
Yeah.
And unless we address those vulnerabilities of people in their lives, then there's no way that we can help them to change their behaviours.
Yeah. Now, Chad, you've come from a biomedical background.
I have.
What led you to move into looking at more the public health kind of issues and not the biomedical?
Yeah, well, I started off in microbiology and at sort of the end of my undergraduate degree, I went over to Uganda in Africa, and I was working in an AIDS hospice, just testing people for tuberculosis. And it was kind of a crossing point for me there that I realised, although I love the science and I love the sort of biomedical work, that I really wanted to work with the people and to engage more with them. So I came back to Australia and then did a master's in public health to get skilled up on how that we work with communities, work with governments, and establish programs where people can respond in that way.
I guess having both those degrees really positions you well, because you've got an understanding of the sort of medical side. Do you find that
you
sort of draw
right.
on that as well as having the people skills?
Yeah, so it gives me the sort of technical skills around virology and around epidemiology, but also then gives me the skills on how do I use that to help other people to understand these issues and to respond to the epidemic.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 Saturday Magazine. We're talking about HIV/AIDS research and overseas development. And our guests are Associate Professor Paul Gorry and Chad Hughes. Paul Gorry, you're an Associate Professor in the Faculty of Medicine at Monash University and working at the Burnet Institute with quite an esteemed history in research, really.
Thanks.
What draws you to the research that you're doing at the moment in HIV?
The thing that draws to me mainly is the importance of the problem.
Yeah.
I think that's probably my primary motivator for doing the work that I do.
Yep.
But I guess, like Chad, I had a similar background in microbiology in an undergraduate sense, and then your career sort of falls into place, not so much initially by what you wanted, well, in my case, what I wanted to do, but what opportunities you had.
Yeah.
And you develop interests to sort of go on from that. So
yeah.
I was fortunate enough when I was working at Fairfield Hospital before it closed in the virology department to get involved with a bunch of researchers from the Macfarlane-Bennet Institute, which was at the time based out there.
Yeah.
And I got to know these people really well and interested in what they did and realised the importance of the work that they did. I wanted to be a part of it, and so I decided I wanted to get into a research career in the HIV field that point.
So what's your current research? What both your current research and the current research in terms of virology, microbiology in HIV at the moment? What's the cutting edge?
Well, my current research is on... I have a few different focuses. Basic HIV pathogenesis is one, and that is how, in infected people, how does HIV evolve to, you know, become more pathogenic and become better able to destroy immune system cells. So I'm quite interested to know in what changes happen in the virus that actually make it, you know, want to harm people in the end. I'm also interested in developing new therapies. I think the work that I've been doing, along with many others, has really formed the platform for the development of new entry inhibitors, because one of my areas of interest is in HIV entry, the mechanisms of how the virus enters the cells.
Right.
And collectively, over the last 10 years or so, that's led to the entry inhibitors like T20 and...
So would they be used mostly as like PEPs, or are they used for like treating someone who is HIV infected to stop the disease developing?
Yes. Entry inhibitors like T20 are in use as part of highly active antiretroviral therapy.
Right.
Although they're not terribly popular, they're not very user-friendly because they have to be injectable, so they're much better options. The newer entry inhibitors such as Maraviroc are the so-called CCR5 inhibitors.
Yeah.
They're quite effective too, but they're problematic as well because you need to have special laboratory testing, which only occurs in the United States. So there's a lot of lag time and turnaround, so they're a little bit unpopular too. But there's no doubt going to be newer generation entry inhibitors, which are going to be more...
So it's entry inhibitors effectively you're talking about things that inhibit the entry of the virus into the host cell to enable it to replicate. So if you can inhibit the entry, you stop the replication of the virus. Is that essentially what happens?
That's exactly what happens. That's one of the attractive features about this class of drug, is that it stops the virus from entering the cell, whereas the current... inhibitors like the reverse transcriptase inhibitors or protease inhibitors, they stop virus being produced from the cell after it's already infected the cell.
Which so if you can stop it even entering, you're
well, that's a better
stopping
situation.
It at first base, really. Yeah, I guess.
Does this have implications for vaccines, or is that a whole different area of virology? And are we closer to developing a vaccine or not?
It does have relevance to vaccines, especially in my field, which is mechanisms of HIV entry. In doing that, we do a lot of cloning and characterizing the envelope proteins from the virus, which actually they're the ones that stud the outside of the virus and use the receptors to get into cells.
So is it like their house? What's what they live in, essentially, what the viral DNA lives in the that you're talking about? Or?
Well, the envelope proteins are the exterior part, not the internal part.
So they're the battering ram or the...
Yeah, that's what they unlock the key to get into the cell.
Right.
And in doing that... we actually discover unique protein conformations or structures of these envelopes. And that has direct relevance for vaccine work because it's thought that an effective vaccine will generate immune responses to control the virus should it encounter it. And those envelope proteins are most likely going to be the most relevant proteins to trigger that immune response. So in a sense, I collaborate with vaccine developers with the knowledge that we get from basic science discoveries.
Why...
So, in terms of collaboration, just is knowledge shared openly, or is it sometimes very much kept within a laboratory or an institute or a country?
It's shared widely, especially in the HIV field. There are many large international meetings that we try to get to. It's happened a couple of times a year, and it's a big, large sharing forum for research. And then there's publications of research and everything. So. I think in the HIV field, there's a lot of sharing going on. But having said that, in the area where we need to patent and protect, there is a little bit of hiding research too, which isn't terribly... Yes.
And the band played on.
Yes, so yes, I was thinking about that.
Should I preface this with another question. Is it taking a long time to develop a vaccine, or does it take this long with most diseases? And if not, why HIV? What's different about HIV that makes it more difficult to develop a vaccine, if indeed that's the case?
It's taking an extraordinarily long time to make a vaccine, and HIV is unlike nearly every other pathogen that I can think of where a vaccine is available, where it was relatively straightforward to make a vaccine. HIV has adopted a number of strategies which make it extremely difficult to make a vaccine against. The way it enters cells is such a conservative mechanism, like it will bind to one receptor one way, and then that triggers another step to bind a second receptor, and it's that intermediate which is probably the Achilles heel of the virus, but it does this in such a way that it just protects itself from the immune system until the very last minute, and then it's too late.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why it's really hard to target immunity against HIV, but there are many
others. It's hard to find the vulnerable place to attack it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. You're listening to Saturday Magazine. We're talking with Associate Professor Paul Gorry and with Chad Hughes from the Burnet Institute about HIV/AIDS and research. Chad, what do you think? We were talking to you earlier about some of the public health issues around HIV and AIDS. How does the public health and the education process intersect with the biomed and the scientific aspect of the development? Do the two obviously need to talk to each other, interact with each other?
Yeah, they do, and that's what's good about Burnet, and where the Burnet Institute is quite unique, because we actually have the laboratory programs who are doing this biomedical research and the interface with the people in the developing countries who really need this sort of technology. Unfortunately, in the absence of a vaccine at this point in time, prevention is still our best mechanism for working with HIV. So a lot of our work still responds to condom use and to behaviour change around safer sex practices and for injecting drug use, not to share needles. But there is a lot of communication between the research that's happening at Burnet and what we're doing, and looking at ways that we can make the technologies that they're working on cost-effective and available and accessible to people in developing countries. Because a lot of medical research leads to technologies which are often, unfortunately, not accessible to the majority of the population of the world where they're needed. So Burnet does their research in a way to look at how do we make these medications or these drugs or these vaccines, but also make them in a way that we can get them out there to people who are living, you know, a 15-hour trek through the jungles in Papua New Guinea.
Is it essentially a logistical issue within the country, or does it involve working with drug companies in terms of availability economically in certain countries? And like, do you lobby drug companies to make medications available at cheaper costs and that kind of thing?
We don't, in my work, do the lobbying of the drug companies themselves. What we do is we help communities prepare for treatments when they're becoming available. Mm-hmm. So we help people understand what is coming out in HIV treatment, in antiretroviral therapy, and what that will mean for their lives, and how that they can incorporate that into their lifestyle in terms of taking their medication every day and looking after their health in general ways as well.
Chad, you were at the recent AIDS conference in Mexico.
Yes, I was.
I would assume that was one of the themes. What other themes were focused on at the conference?
Well, the main sort of outcome from this conference, the previous conferences have really focused on treatment, because treatment was the new push. And as it became more available and the costs of the drugs came down, more people have been able to access those treatments. So now there's 3 million people around the world who are on antiretroviral therapy, which is great. Though there is an acknowledgement that for every 2 people that are going on to treatment, there's 5 new infections happening on HIV. So we're not going to treat our way out of the epidemic. You know, prevention is still our best strategy. And so there was a real reinvigoration of the push to focus again on prevention and to really help people to understand how they can protect themselves from HIV. Yeah.
And was there much representation from people from developing countries?
Conference? There was, yeah. I mean, it was in a developing country, in Mexico. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of representation from Latin America, which was good, because there's not many people from there at previous conferences. But, yeah, lots of people from all over the world.
What's happening worldwide epidemiologically in terms of infection rates and so forth at the moment?
Well, it seems to... Of course, it depends on the part of the world that you're talking about, and some epidemics are still going exponentially up, and others have seemed to have stabilised.
Is that essentially in Africa, or is it other parts of the world as well?
Well, sub-Saharan Africa still has very concentrated and high epidemics. Other parts of the world, for example, in our region where I work in Southeast Asia, the epidemic is still very much associated with behaviours like injecting drug use and the sharing of equipment, with sex between men and with the purchase and the sale of sex and commercial sex.
Yeah.
So for countries outside of sub-Saharan Africa, there is an acknowledgement that we really do need to refocus on those behaviours.
Mm. And are governments aware of that and supporting the sort of programs that you and other workers in those countries are doing, like the Asian governments, for example?
Yeah, some. There's a lot of advocacy is in our work. So we work with the governments in discussion about what are the issues and what they need to do. Of course, when you're talking about drug use, you're talking about sex work and you're talking about, you know, sex between men. These are very difficult topics for governments to talk about. So we have to do a lot of background work in terms of getting them to understand why it's important, why these people need access to programs. And of course, when some of these aspects of people's lives are also illegal in countries, then there's that whole debate around, you know, how do we service people with what they need to protect themselves
when
from
they're not
HIV?
Even willing to sort of come forward and discuss it, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. Do you think that governments like are more conservative in terms of attitudes towards homosexuality, say, or injecting drug use, are changing? Do you think that they are becoming more open in terms of those kind of attitudes? Or is it having to fight those attitudes constantly?
No, I think some are. I mean, Mexico was a very good example where the Mexican government has really got on board. They had an anti-homophobia march at the beginning of the conference, where thousands of people turned out in the public square to support that. And there was acknowledgements at the plenary from the, you know, the president and the head of the National AIDS program there that unless we're dealing with homophobia, unless we're getting the rights in there for men who have sex with men, then we can't make an impact on the epidemic. So things are changing. It just depends really on the country.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. It's such a Catholic-based country. Yeah. Mind you, a lot of the changes have been in Catholic countries in Europe around other things, surprisingly, more than even perhaps places closer to home.
Yeah, that's right.
It's true. You're listening to Saturday Magazine with Leanne Renfrey and Jeff Hood, and we're talking about HIV/AIDS research and overseas development. And our guests are Chad Hughes, who's the International HIV and Development Program Officer at the Burnet Institute, and Associate Professor Paul Gorrie, who's the Laboratory Head and Principal Fellow of the Centre for Virology at the Burnet Institute.
Keeping our community informed. Join 94.5.
You're listening to Saturday Magazine with Jeff and Leanne, and that was Taylor Dane, Can't Get Enough of Your Love.
And speaking about HIV/AIDS research and overseas development, Associate Professor Paul Gorrie and Chad Hughes from the Burnet Institute. Paul, just a little bit, we were talking in the break about antimicrobicides and so forth. Just before we get on to that, I just want to ask you about PEP, or post-exposure prophylaxis, as it's called. What is it? I'm sure that most of our listeners would have heard of it, but some might say, oh yeah, PEP, heard of that, don't know what it is. What does it do?
Well, it's a formulation of anti-HIV drugs similar to what's used to treat HIV.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also reasonably effective in preventing HIV transmission after a high-risk encounter, like for a possible safe sex encounter, or, you know, in a hospital sense that I'm more used to, a possible needle stick injury.
Right.
So PEP can be offered to reduce the chance of a...
How long after possible contact or infection can it be used? Like, does it need to be within 24 hours or...?
I don't really know.
Within 72 hours.
Right.
But recommended to have started as soon as possible after the possible exposure.
Okay. So it's kind of jump onto it as soon as you can.
Yeah.
All right, antimicrobicides, like we were talking early with Chad about what's happening overseas and trying to prevent infection as the first port of call, given that, you know, trying to treat what's there is going to be a difficult task. Tell us about antimicrobicides and their role in preventing the infection or preventing the spread of the epidemic.
Yeah, I wanted to raise microbicides because it's a very important prevention strategy which is being developed and should be developed. Which is distinct to developing HIV drugs and vaccines. It's an area of basic research which intersects the public health programs that Chad is involved in. And it's particularly important at the moment for places like sub-Saharan Africa, where infection rates are extremely high. And importantly, and really sadly, that in some areas of Africa, the single biggest risk factor for a woman acquiring HIV is being married. And that's a really shocking and sad fact. Mm-hmm. And microbicides are basically formulations, vaginal formulations, gels and creams, which can then kill the virus, should virus be present.
Because the virus is fairly fragile outside of the body, isn't it?
It is fragile.
Yeah, unlike like influenza can float around the air, but HIV is dead within a short time, is that right?
That's true. There's a double-edged sword with microbicides, though, is that these formulations have to be really non-toxic. It's very easy for some of them. A bad case was Nonoxynil 9, which was originally used as a spermicide.
Mm.
And was tried as a microbicide as well, but it actually increased transmissions because it actually caused damage to the inside of the vagina. So they've got to be very safe, and they can't do any harm. Mm-hmm. But the important thing about microbicides is it has the potential to empower women when they sometimes can't negotiate safe sex.
I suppose if they're in a marriage, saying no to sex with their husband be difficult, particularly in those cultures.
In some cultures.
And then discussing safe sex practice could be difficult as well.
Yeah.
So at least that gives them. So would that happen after sex?
Before. Yep.
Okay. So has that started, or is this a really very new initiative at the moment? Or have they started programs of distributing microbicides?
Well, they've started developing microbicides. Right. There's a lot of work in microbicide development, and there are clinical trials that are being underway. Mm.
So essentially it's got to be something that's non-toxic in terms of like damaging the lining of the vagina to make transmission of the virus easier, but to kill it off without actually harming the anatomical structure, is that the task? How close is that to developing microbicides that will do that?
Well, there have been some studies in monkeys which look very promising. The clinical trials in people, the ones that have been progressing, haven't been terribly successful, unfortunately. But I think that the people that are controlling these trials know how they can improve them better. Mm. And I think it's an area which we can actually capitalise on rapidly.
Mm.
Whereas because vaccine development is so slow, microbicide development could be a whole lot quicker.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's something that really should happen in tandem, which could save many lives.
Mm. Mm. Chad, once this is developed, how easy will it be to get it to get out education programs and to have it available in developing countries?
Well, the importance of this sort of technology, as Paul said, is that it's something that can be controlled by females. Mm. And with regards to safe sex, the use or no use of a condom often comes down to the decision of the man in any context, whether that's within a marriage or whether that's in casual sex or commercial sex. So we try to get as many technologies for women who are often more vulnerable to not being able to negotiate safer sex due to power differentials in different cultures.
Yes.
So that's what's going to be really important. It's then going to be a matter of working with the women to get them to see whether they find this product acceptable, whether because it's a fairly personal thing to then be putting a gel on before sex, and when's that going to happen, and how are they going to know that sex is going to occur and all that time. So there's going to be these trials of acceptability before they can actually be rolled out and then the education starts. But hopefully the technology comes, because we need as many tools as we can have in terms of public health prevention of the transmission of HIV. At the moment we have female condoms, which are different to the typical male latex condom, which goes on the penis, and they're inserted in the vagina prior to sex as well. And so they're available in Burma and in Papua New Guinea, where I work. So we work with women about, this is a technology you can use and you can control, where you're in control of whether there's a barrier.
What's the response been?
It varies. Some women really like them, some women don't like them. So what we do is we make them available, we teach women how to use them, and then we encourage them to go and try the product to see whether it works for them. And for some women, it's something that they use quite often and all the time, and for other women, they find it uncomfortable.
Do they depend at all, like the female condom, does that depend at all on the male cooperation for them to work effectively, or can they be inserted and used without?
It can, and they can also be used. A lot of women tell me that often the man doesn't even know that the female condom's in there, especially if he's coming home and he's had a few drinks and he's quite drunk, and the sex happens pretty quickly, then he can be oblivious to the fact that it's there, and the women really like that. Otherwise, it's something that you can obviously negotiate with your partner as well.
Yeah,
sounds good. What What next do you think in terms of public health? Like, what are the big cutting edge issues and things that need to be developed? And maybe let's talk a little bit about that question in terms of Australia. Like, Australia's response to the AIDS epidemic initially was very good compared to other countries in the world. Where are we now, and where are we going? Where do we need to go?
Well, I think Australia's response to HIV is still good. I mean, we've kept the epidemic really low amongst people who inject drugs, unlike countries like the United States of America, which never put into place programs like needle and syringe programs. Australia was one of the first countries to really put that out there in the public health domain and make those programs available. So we halted that epidemic really before it even got a kickstart. In terms of HIV spread in Australia, yes, it's still mainly about sex between men and unprotected sex between men. And as we know, the notifications are going up slightly from previous years. I think there's some really good organisations out there doing good work. It's just a case of government support and funding and keeping those initiatives going. And then always asking the questions about what's changing, why people changing their behaviours, what's happening for people, and being dynamic. You know, yes. We can't assume that what we were trying 10 years ago is going to work today. We need to keep asking the questions of the people. Why are you not using condoms anymore? Finding out the reasons and then working with them around those issues.
So there's kind of a lot of social research needing to be done in that area. The Burnet Institute has a fantastic reputation for research, and the multidisciplinary approach of it makes it quite different from, say, scientific research centres of 20, 30 years ago. Paul, you've recently won the Young Tall Poppy Science Award. What's that? It's a fascinating name.
it's an award which is really designed to enable the winners to be advocates for science to younger people, particularly high school students.
Right.
And I think one of the good things about it, in my case, is that it's recognition of the HIV work that's been done in Melbourne, and I'm really happy about that because it really does draw attention to the good work that the Burnet does. But one of the things that I do like to do is to try and have a positive influence on people, and I'm actually looking forward to the opportunities now, which are part of the obligations of being the winner of this award, to conduct workshops in high schools and give talks and try and promote science as a rewarding discipline that can make meaningful differences to individuals.
So not only spreading the word about what you're doing, but might be inspiring young people to actually follow that path into
science.
Yeah,
that's part of the point of it, I think.
And it's because one of the good things that's happening in medical education now too is that medicine is being seen, or has always been seen, but is in education is being seen much more now as having a social aspect to it, not just being biomedical. And you know, I know that medical students are receiving a lot more training in like medical sociology and so forth, and that's one of the great things about the Burnet Institute is that combination. Tell us about the romp, the Melbourne City romp that's happening. It's, we've talked about it a little bit earlier on the program. Do you guys know anything about
it? Are you going to participate?
It's on Sunday the 19th of October. It's a fundraiser. And there's over $100,000 worth of prizes. And there's four categories that you can join: family and friends, corporate romp, schools romp, and university romp. And it's there are limited numbers, so you need to sign up.
3,000, I think.
Yeah,
there's a lot 3, of people 000. Romping around the city looking for clues and doing things. It should be fun.
Yeah, it's a sort of a combination of a treasure hunt and
the amazing race where people sort of bump each other out of the way to be the first ones to get to something.
I think the good thing about this, though, is it's a very family-friendly event. It's not like a fun run or thing that's something that excludes people. Yeah. It's very family-friendly.
Okay. Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, guys, thank you for joining us on Saturday Magazine this morning. It's interesting always to catch up with what's happening in terms of the cutting edge around HIV, both in a social sense and in a medical sense. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Chad Hughes, who's the International HIV and Development Program Officer at the Burnet Institute, and Associate Professor Paul Gorrie, who's the Laboratory Head and Principal Fellow of the Centre for Virology.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.